No. She comes here in the middle of the night and tells us she can just make us a baby after all. No. No. Leave right now!
I'm so sorry. I think you misunderstood me. I'm not going to make you a baby. I already did.
Hello and welcome back to the Cephala Podcast, where we are discussing the HBO show Watchmen. I'm your host, Scott.
And I'm Jason.
And today we are discussing Season 1, Episode 4, which is titled, If You Don't Like My Story, Write Your Own. Before we get started, I want to talk a little bit about the recap. There are a couple things from the last episode that I want to re-go over. So the last episode ends with Angela's car falling out of the sky right in front of Lori. And that is, essentially the brick joke manifest. You remember that brick joke that the girl was telling where she started the joke and then, you know, at the very end of the episode, the joke came back and the brick hit God and killed God or St. Peter or whatever. That was essentially the car falling too. It was introduced the episode before, you've completely forgotten about it, and then at the end it comes back. So there was sort of an analogy there.
Does that mean that Lady True is the girl in her story?
Is Lady True? Possibly. I don't know. I guess I haven't really thought about that because... Well, you'll see a little bit more of Lady True. She's pretty, I want to say, powerful. And yeah, it's possible. I mean, let's come back to that theme, actually. Okay. And the other thing, and I don't know if I explained it enough in the last episode, is that Lady True is building a millennium clock. And if you remember when Petey's looking out the window at the clock, he mentions, what does he say? The statue was erected, and the quote on the bottom of the statue is, "Look on my works, ye mighty, and despair," which is a quote from that Ozymandias poem. And we talked about it a little bit, but in that Ozymandias poem, there was a statue built to a famous, I think it was a warrior. And so that's essentially what Lady True is doing here, is that she is building this monument, this clock, to, as a, I don't know, I want to say like an homage, or like not an homage, that's not the right word, but like as a tribute to a powerful person. That doesn't really come up in the episode. That's a little behind the scenes stuff, but you'll see as we move forward what she has planned for this. But there's a reason that it has that quote, and it's analogous to, you know, the original quote from that play from what, the 1800s. Nothing mind bending, but I just wanted to mention those two things. So we'll start with the episode. The episode opens, the intro, the yellow letters that say Watchmen are like egg yolks. So we're back to the egg theme. And then the scene opens with a lady sitting, a farmer sitting on the side of the road, and she is attempting to sell eggs. So she is on an egg farm. So we are just like, you know, whatever, 40 seconds into this episode, and we're just knee deep in eggs. We see there's a farmer lady, and her name is Ma Clark, and she is reading a book called Fog Dancing. And I looked this up, and it's a fictional book, and I won't go into all the details, but in the original Watchmen comic, there was an author who ends up writing this book. And ultimately, this book is about loneliness, and I guess that's all I want to say. This book is about loneliness, and the book will come up, I believe, one other time later. It's not super important, but it's interesting to note that the theme of this book that she is, this fictional book that she is reading, is loneliness. We see this couple that is on this farm, this lady reading this book. They kind of have this marriage montage. You know, I forget, they're, you know, cooking in the kitchen, they're brushing their teeth, they're just doing, you know, farmer style things, and they get in bed, and like the husband is reaching for the night light or the light on the nightstand, and then the doorbell rings. So you clearly, it's, you know, whatever, 10 o'clock at night, and they're not expecting anybody at the door, so they're a little alarmed. They get up and they go to the door, and it's Lady True, and this is our first introduction to Lady True. And she's, I want to say, like, ominous. Like, she's on the porch, you know, in the dark. Like, she's purposely, they don't have the porch lights off or whatever. Like, they kind of have this weird introduction where she starts talking in the dark. And she comes in, you know, they invite her in. They're kind of like, you know, a little surprised because she's kind of a celebrity. She's, you know, I think we said she's the Elon Musk of this universe. She's rich and famous and an inventor. And she comes in, and I noticed that they're sitting in her front room, and there's a half put together puzzle of Starry Night on the table. Lady True mentions that she is a trillionaire. I think at one point they say, "Aren't you a billionaire?" And she says, "No, no, no, I'm a trillionaire." And she's kind of a recluse. She's kind of a hermit. She doesn't come out a lot. You know, I mean, she's not a people person. She's, that's her business is, you know, business is being a trillionaire. But she says she made an exception that tonight you are the most important people in the world for the next 3 minutes. And I did note that her outfit, she's wearing all white, like head to toe white. She kind of looks like Moon Knight almost. It was kind of a weird choice. I don't know if there's more to it, but she's dressed entirely in white. And Lady True gives this kind of impassioned speech about legacy. What she wants to do is she wants to buy their farm. And she basically gives them, I think she says 3 minutes. She has like a little sand timer, and she says, "You got to give me a yes or no. You know, I want this farm." And they're like, "Well, it's not for sale. Like, this is kind of our family farm." And she says, "No, I understand." She says, "This farm is your legacy." But her quote was, "Legacy isn't in land, it's in blood, passed to us from our ancestors and by us to our children." So there's a theme here of her legacy and this farm legacy. And she wants to buy this farm. It's not clear why she wants to buy this farm, but she's adamant. She showed up at this farm at 10 o'clock at night, and she's basically kind of trying to bully these people into selling their farm. And they're like, "No, we're not interested. I'm not selling this farm." And she makes mention that part of her fortune has been made in the biotech industry, and that she said she owns 1,000 clinics, including a fertility clinic. One, the fertility clinic that this couple had used. And she said, you know, "You attempted to get an embryo, but you were told that your eggs weren't viable." So again, another reference to eggs. And they get the impression that she's going to attempt to offer them, you know, an embryo or a baby. And the couple gets really upset because clearly they've had fertility problems. I'm sure this is a very sensitive subject for them. And the wife, Ma Clark, stands up and just yells, "Get out." And Lady True says, "You misunderstand me. I've already made you a baby." And she ultimately ends up offering the Clarks is a baby made from, you know, this woman's eggs, and $5 million in a bank account in exchange for this farm, because she really, really wants this farm. And I think Bien is at the door and brings in an actual baby. So there is, you know, this isn't a ruse. This isn't a trick. There is an actual human baby here. And the Clarks are completely blown away because, again, they've been told that they're infertile. They ultimately agree, and the lights flash, like the electricity flickers a little bit, and they all go outside, and they're standing on the porch of this house, and you see like a comet or a meteor or something land, and Lady True gets all excited about it. And I think one of them says, "Oh, what's that?" And Lady True just responds, "That's mine." It was a pretty intense scene, and it's clearly designed to let Lady True throw her weight around, both her popularity and her money. You know, she really essentially kind of bulldozes this family and forces them to make it, you know, an impossible decision in 3 minutes. But ultimately they decide because they get a baby and $5 million out of it. So do you have any comments about this before I go into a little bit of the background on Lady True?
I just thought it was kind of a very ridiculous scene. I mean, I don't really know anything about Lady True at this point, so you know, it just feels like, you know, pretty on the nose. Like this couple, she trips and like breaks the eggs, and like she's sitting out there on her front porch trying to sell eggs, and no, you know, she looks so sad.
Right.
Like literally everything about these people is just is sort of a two-dimensional like point that they're trying to make, and the weird you know, like, this baby could be anything. It seems weird to accept this deal on the spot without any, like, double checking or anything.
But you wouldn't just blindly accept a baby when somebody knocked on your door at 10 o'clock at night and said, here's a baby?
I mean, I would, but I'm different. You know?
Yeah, okay, sure.
But it just felt pretty crazily ridiculous and on the nose and, yeah, a bit comical, I guess. But
it's very, yeah, I mean, I think you hit the nail on the head. It's designed to be a little out of character for, you know, I guess normal people. But that's Lady True's style, is she's just very flamboyant and flashy, right? I mean, she's got a lot of money and a lot of ambition, and you know when you're that rich, the rules don't apply to you. So I did a little bit of looking on Wikipedia that Lady True was actually a real person. She was a warrior in the 3rd century Vietnam, who managed for a time, at least this is all according to Wikipedia, to resist the rule of the Chinese. So I assume this character is based on, you know, her, just because the name is kind of unique. There's a quote on Wikipedia that said, "I'd like to ride storms, kill orcas in the open sea, drive out the aggressors, reconquer the country, undo the ties of serfdom, and never bend my back to be the concubine of whatever man." So this woman was a warrior, and she was very, you know, I want to say outspoken. So clearly this is a reference to, you know, whoever this warrior was from, I'm doing the math, 1800 years ago. So.
Okay. So there's an overhead shot of the farm. And I had a question about this. It it hovers over the title of the episode, you know, like it's been doing in the previous ones. It has like a physical representation of the title, the letters in whatever scene. And then it dissolves into like a parking lot, and it looks like we're next to Sister Knight's bakery, outdoor shopping area, whatever it is. Is this supposed to be the same location as that? Is it like a time jump forward to the same spot, or is it just a fancy editing?
No, I think that's just a fancy cut because, okay, you know, Lady True and Angela and the Clarks all live in present day. So I think it was just a cut.
Okay. Yeah, I guess it just threw me off how the lamp post kind of dissolved over this field, and it was like a static shot of this one area. Okay, yeah, so we see Angela go into her business, her bakery building, another quick shot of eggs. So, yeah, definitely some eggs here. And then we see Will's wheelchair, and she starts, like, tearing it apart and, like, you know, breaking it down into pieces and putting it into like a duffel bag, looks like. She picks up that old note that says, "Watch over this boy," is from the very first scene in the series. And she looks, I think she turns on the burner, and it looks like she's going to burn this note over her gas stove. And then we hear a message on the answering machine. You know, like one of those old school answering machines, leave a message and then everything, it's like blaring. Like I don't know if anyone had a message answering machine like that.
I do. Want to note that her answering machine message is, "Hi, you've reached the Milk and Hanoi Bakery, where we let the Saigons be Saigons," which, yeah, I just thought was a great, like, Vietnam pun. It's not related to anything. It's just, there's a lot of puns in relation to this bakery. So.
Well, yeah, what's the name of her bakery? It's
the Milk and Hanoi Bakery.
Milk and Hanoi, yeah, she's very pun heavy. And I haven't seen her do any puns in real life, though, so I don't know. Anyway, so there's the message from the Greenwood Center for Cultural Heritage saying that they have information about a new branch of her family tree. And it looks, and as she's listening to this, the note catches on fire on the fire, and she freaks out and stomps it out. Like she's sort of changed her mind, I guess, on burning this note. And so then she goes to the cultural center place, the Greenwood Center for Cultural Heritage. She calls into, I guess, like dispatch or something, and says, ask them about a silent alarm at this place. Sort of as a ruse to, like, because she intends to break in. She does break in, and so it would, like, it would cover that and cover her for her break-in, basically.
Well, it's not clear. Like, you originally, like, you think she's there, like, actually investigating, you know, like she's like she got a tip on something.
Yeah.
And then she calls in. Oh, yeah. Did you get any alarms on this? And they're like, no. And she's like, oh, well, if you get a silent alarm, if you get an alarm trip, it's just me. And then she just punches the window straight. Like, no hesitation. Mm-hmm. It was great.
Yeah, she's kind of breaking some laws here, but she's covering her tracks. And so she gets in to this thing and goes to a kiosk. Back to that same kiosk that she went to before to, like, submit the DNA evidence or the DNA for the history check. And she gets an acorn, which they say is encoded with her family tree, I believe, which she has to take to the, quote, greenhouse and to plant. So she puts the acorn in a glowing tube.
I thought it was kind of cool, you know, like, you know, it would be something you'd see at a real museum. Like, they have to encode an acorn with her family tree, which she then plants and it grows into a tree. You know, it's just a visual representation of a family tree, which is kind of cool.
Yeah, it's an interesting way of doing it. So yeah, the tree it's like a hologram of a tree that pops up, which I guess is supposed to represent her family. And she taps her, like, a picture of her father, to grow that branch, which shows her grandma and Will, which doesn't have a picture. You know, the other profiles have a picture, but Will is blank. And the voiceover says that it's about 99.9% certain that it's her paternal grandfather. And the tree starts showing Will's history. His parents were the mother and father in the first episode who got their baby boy or little boy onto that escape caravan thing with the note. So the old man, Will, who is her grandpa, his parents are the ones in that first episode in the Tulsa Massacre. So, yeah, we're zeroing in on Will being the boy from that first episode.
What we see, I don't know if it's important, but I did note that Marcus Abar is her father and June is her mother. Those are the names that are given by the tree. We will meet them later. And like you said, Will isn't in the database yet. They have a question mark for a picture for him. Obi Williams is her great grandfather, and Ruth Robeson is her great grandmother. I made note of those names. I can't remember if they come back in the future, but I did write them down.
And those are the people in that first episode, right? Her great great grandpa.
Yes,
great grandparents. Yeah.
Yes, I believe so.
And they were killed and the voiceover says that the entire family was killed in that massacre in 1921, but. That doesn't really work out if the grandparent is the part of that family that was massacred, although he reproduced.
Clearly, Will is still, yeah, right.
So, yeah, I don't know. So she talks to the hologram and says, she's looking at the little boy in the hologram. She says, leave me the fuck alone. Something about, like, you disappeared for a while and then you came back and fucked up my life and then disappeared again. And then she hears a crash outside. So
she runs outside because, yes, indeed, there was quite a large crash. And I don't know. It's probably 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock at night. It's dark outside. And, yeah, she gets out to the parking lot and it's Lori. And this is right after the end of the last episode where the car falls out of the sky. And Lori's laughing, just again, like the last episode. And like the car alarm is going off, you know, so this car has fallen from the sky and the car alarm's going crazy. Yeah, and the car is trashed.
Like she's like hackling.
Yes.
Or cackling. That's the right word. Cackling.
Sister Knight walks over and she shuts off the alarm at one point. So she gets in the car. She's in the driver's seat. And she calls dispatch for a tow truck because this car is destroyed and it's not drivable. She checks the glove compartment real quick And all we see an amber bottle, which was Will's pills. If you'll remember, he had the pills in his hand when he was in the car when it was taken away. Lori asks, you know, was anything taken? And Sister Knight says, no, you know, it looks like it's just kind of trashed. And then Lori mentions, I think she calls Sister Knight Angela by name. And Sister Knight's a little bit alarmed because she's, you know, in full costume. So the fact that Lori knows that Angela and Sister Knight are the same person is a little bit disturbing to her. So there's a brief hesitation, like, okay, the cat's out of the bag. You know, I can have this double life, but Lori knows about it, so I need to be a little bit more careful. And that's the end of that scene. And then it cuts, and Angela has now made it home, and she gets home, and this is the same day as Judd's funeral, and so she's still kind of, it's been a crazy day for her, and she's all, you know, amped up and having problems sleeping and probably still processing the funeral and, you know, the 7th Cavalry attack at the funeral, so it's been a crazy day for her. She can't sleep in her own bed because the daughters are sleeping with Cal in their bed, and so she goes into Topher's room and sleeps on the bottom bunk, and Topher is there, and he's still awake. And he's kind of processing things because you have to remember that her kids were at the funeral when, you know, this 7th Cavalry member was shot in the head, you know, and there was blood everywhere. That was probably extremely traumatic. Mm-hmm. Topher said he's awake because he's still kind of processing seeing that guy get murdered. Luckily, he says his sisters didn't see it, so they weren't as scared, but he's clearly having problems processing it. And I think he asks Angela, you know, were you scared? And she says, yes. And I still am a little bit. And like a hand slowly reaches over from the bunk bed and he lowers his stuffed animal to Angela. It was a pretty cute little scene. You want to cover the next scene?
Well, it goes to the morning. And there's a shot of Cal cracking an egg into a bowl. So more eggs.
Doing some more eggs, huh?
It's a very egg-heavy episode. Maybe you'll explain to me why that is, but it's a theme, I guess. So there, it seems to be like the kids are fighting about Uncle Judd going to heaven, and Cal sort of explains how he lived and died and just doesn't exist anymore. Kind of a weird scene of him explaining that.
He's explaining essentially heaven and hell to the kids, right? That she's convinced that Uncle Judd went to heaven, and Cal like levels with her. He was like, you know, essentially he's like, I don't believe in heaven. When you're dead, you just stop existing. And I think Angela kind of gives him the side eye, like, what are you telling our kids?
Oh, I didn't catch that. I didn't know that Angela didn't quite approve of his explanation. Is that true, or has that come up?
It wasn't a big deal. Like, he kind of goes, you know, off the reservation, and he walks over and he explains to the little girl that, you know, at least in his mind, that heaven doesn't exist. And then as the scene, I think they walk over and Angela kind of looks at him, and she's like, just kind of just surprised, not angry, just like, oh, you know, I think, you know, as somebody that has kids, regardless of what you believe, especially when you have kids that little, because how old are those daughters? You know what? 6, 7. You know, maybe you kind of like soften the blow a little bit, you know. I think that's the whole concept of, you know, existentialism and nothingness is probably a little bit heavy for a 7-year-old. So maybe you just kind of like go along with it until they're older. But
yeah, that's weird. So this kind of brings up like in the first scene of the show, you know, we have this sort of comical scenario of this couple that is nothing but lonely and wants a kid. And so it's like very comically set up and like and so it's obviously more of an iconic scene. It's trying to send you a message rather than have characters in the show be people. And so like when something like this scene happens, I wonder what the show is trying to say, rather than being just a scene with people talking to each other. I feel like there's like a hidden message in everything because things are so boldly presented and things are so weird, right? So
This was a weird scene, and I don't know if there's anything else really here. I mean, I think it was just a way to show that the family is adjusting to, you know, Judd was, the kids called him Uncle Judd, and he was a big part of their lives, and they're coming to terms with it. I mean, Cal and Angela are going to have to come to terms with this guy being dead, and the kids are, you know, so I don't know if there's a whole lot more here. I wouldn't look too much into this scene. It was, well, like you said, it was just kind of a weird one-off.
Yeah, it stuck out to me, I guess, but yeah. So I think from here we just go to Angela goes to Wade's place and is like and knocks on a rusty door that appears to be leading to an underground hideout.
He's got a bunker. He's got like a fallout shelter.
Yeah. What's he doing here? He's taking photos of the squids and stuff, I guess. Mm-hmm. I didn't really understand what's going on.
So he says that he chases Squidfall. So, I mean, remember that it's a regular occurrence in this universe.
Oh, Squidfall. I didn't know that was the name of it.
Yeah, that squids regularly fall from the air and cause problems. And he got an alert that, you know, I forget where it was, someplace within driving distance had a recent Squidfall. And he had driven out there to take pictures before the squids decomposed. And so in this part of what's in his bunker is a dark room. And he is, you know, like paper and chemicals actually developing photos of squids that he had taken on his last Squidfall adventure.
I think if I was, you know, along with our podcast, I would call it Celepha precipitation.
Wow.
Does that make sense? Yes. Yeah, precipitation.
I'll give you Damon Lindelof's email. You can send him an email.
That would have been better. I can't even say it, but it would have been better. Yeah.
It would have been so much better, that word you can't say. Yeah. So Angela hands Wade, Looking Glass, these pills, the Will's pills from her glove compartment. What am I talking about? And she says, hey, can you have your ex analyze these? Doesn't she have a lab? And he was like, well, yeah, but, you know, we're the police. We have a lab. And she was like, yeah, I kind of don't want to use that lab. And, you know, he's reluctant to have to go ask his ex for a favor. But I think he reads the writing between the lines that, you know, maybe there's something that she wants off the record. So he takes these pills. And they kind of debate back and forth. They're still grappling with Judd's death too, because this was their boss and he was well liked. And Angela says, you know, he was a racist. And Wade's response was, he was a white man in Oklahoma. So I think he's just kind of implying that, you know, everybody, you know, if you're a white man in Oklahoma, everybody's a little bit racist, I think is what he's saying. And Angela, she gets out the Klan robes. She's like, yeah, he had a secret compartment in his closet, and this is what I found in there. You know, and he goes back and forth. He's like, well, these are old, you know, maybe these were his grandfather's and he kept this as a keepsake. And then they kind of, you know, debate a little bit about whether or not their boss was a racist. You know, was he not this person that we thought he was? You know, we thought he was this up and up guy. He was the chief of police. He was a popular guy, but you know, what's going on with this guy? Maybe he has some crazy secret past that we don't know about. I mean, clearly at minimum, he's got Klan robes hidden in his closet. So,
well, I don't think they do much talking. Like Wade is pretty like man, a few words. I am surprised by his reaction to the robes, the KKK robes, because, or the outfit, because he doesn't seem to react very much. Like you say, he says, well, he's a dude in Oklahoma, a white dude. What are you going to come at me with, some tweet he did 3 years ago or something? but no, she presents a KKK robe and he's like, oh, well, his granddaddy, I mean, that's a good excuse. His granddaddy was a sheriff, I guess that's very possible. But I'm surprised that he wasn't like, whoa.
Yeah.
At least a little bit, but yeah.
Agreed. So it was it was definitely weird. They're trying to wrap their heads around this, you know. I mean, it'd be like me finding out that you had some, you know, crazy past, you know, like we've been friends a long time. You think you know somebody, you think like you understand how they work and how they think, and then all of a sudden like this crazy thing comes out. So I mean they're grappling with it, and then clearly they're doing their jobs. They're detectives and they're trying to get to the bottom of the story and figure how much of it's true and where it goes. We see the next scene is Angela does another like cool superhero montage where she suits up. I really like the cinematography of the while she's suiting up. It just looks cool. I mean, I don't have a lot to say other than that, other than just the way they put it together is aesthetically pleasing.
Like I did spray paints her eyes.
Yes, you know, and like they do the close up of the gloves sliding on her arms and she cinches her belt. You know, they just little stuff. It's just cool looking. Mm-hmm. I did note, and I'm sure this has been in other episodes, I just haven't seen it before, that her suit has a rosary attached, you know, sort of around the middle where the belt is, you know, so just to play into the theme of Sister Night, like she's a nun. I mean, it's not, it's probably horribly, you know, it's not practical, you know, it doesn't do anything. It probably gets in the way, you know, and if you're running, it's probably slapping against your legs and whatnot, but she's got a rosary, so whatever.
It looks a little bit like anal beads to me, you know.
Oh. Okay, I'll take your word for it.
Maybe that has something to do with this next scene.
Maybe. All right. So, what we so
I'm 12, I guess.
Yeah. Angela has the duffel bag that she has all the pieces of Will's wheelchair that she needs to dispose of, so that she's not going to tie herself to Will as, you know, an accomplice or whatever. And she's on this overpass, and she throws it into a garbage truck that's passing underneath. You know, and she kind of breathes a sigh of relief. Okay, you know, this is out of my possession. I don't have to worry about, you know, getting connected with this guy. And then, like, she looks over her shoulder, and there's a skinny guy in, like, a head-to-toe, like, reflective white suit, you know, with, like, bug-eye-looking things on. It just looks really out of place. And she was like, I think she says, "What the fuck?" and she gives this guy chase, or he takes off running. Mm-hmm. And she was like, "Well, I got to chase this guy because he just saw me dispose of evidence. And this guy is really weird looking. And, you know, they're in a universe where masked vigilantes are illegal. So it's her job to chase this guy down." So they run through this junkyard. I mean, they're just both, you know, full on sprinting. Mm-hmm. And he runs down this, you know, this gets to this straight section of road, and he pulls like two, you know, like ketchup dispenser things you would see at a restaurant, and he squirts, you know, it's lube essentially. You don't know what it is at the time. I thought it was going to be water or like lighter fluid the first time I saw it, but he like covers himself in this and then just like slides into this storm drain. He lubes himself up and slides into the storm drain. That's how he escapes Angela, her chase. And she just kind of gets over to the storm drain, and there's a big streak of oil or lube on the street where he has slid into this storm drain. And it's a really surreal scene, and she is not happy that this guy has gotten away, because he has seen her disposing of evidence, and, you know, maybe there's something else going on here. He was watching her, so whatever's going on, you know, her alarm bells are going off, like somebody's keeping an eye on me. So now I'm really curious what your take on this scene was, because I know what's going on here, but I'm looking for a novice's interpretation of this scene.
I have no fucking idea, really. I mean, I assume that there's like a shadowy organization centered around Lady True, and maybe he's involved with that. Given like what we know later in the episode, or barely hinted at later in the episode, but it's hard. Yeah, it's really out of the blue, and I would have appreciated, you know. So I assume that he's maybe someone keeping tabs on her for some reason, and is associated with the opposition, whether it be like the 7th Cavalry or Lady True, or those are combined of some sort, maybe. I don't know. I guess I would appreciate, I appreciate this character, Lube Man. I think he's cool. But I would have appreciated maybe a character we already knew, like we recognized, because, you know, I'm being introduced to too much stuff. So it'd been nice to see a familiar character there, but that's, you know, that's the extent of my...
Okay. Well, I mean, you're just straight up wrong, because every scene should have Lube Man in it. He is my favorite character.
I mean,
he's just so insane.
Yeah, Lube Man's great. I'm pro Lube Man.
For what it's worth, I don't think he's ever given a name in the show, but he's credited as Lube Man, and it's just... Well, maybe Angela, maybe they call him that back at the precinct when she gets back. He's just this really insane character that comes out of the blue, and he comes back, I think, one other time, so we'll see. It's like that scene is just so insane, where it's just this skinny-looking dude running down the street, covering himself in lube to slide into the storm drain.
Yeah.
Back at the police station, Angela meets... she sees Keen as she's getting off the elevator. She's got the I don't know, the bat belt, I don't know what you want to call it, from Lube Man. She's taking it back to the station to analyze, to figure out if they can get any information on out of these lube bottles or whatever. But Keen catches her getting off the elevator, and he mentions she's still dressed up like Sister Knight, and Keen calls her Angela, and she kind of does a double take, because now he knows that she has an alter ego too. So this is both Lori now and Senator Keen both realize what her, you know, I guess side job is. Cause remember, she had told Lori before, Lori says, "Oh, aren't you a cop?" And she's, "Oh, I used to be, now I'm retired." So she has this, you know, persona where she's not very clearly not open about being a cop, but two high-ranking important people know who she is.
I feel like this was heavily already implied earlier on that he knows who she is, Laurie knows. Like, it doesn't seem like a very well-kept secret.
Right. Me.
Yeah.
She takes the lube belt and shows it to Pirate Jenny and Red Scare. She's like, "You guys ever seen anything like this?" You know, she kind of explains the story a little bit. And then I think at one point, like, Red Scare, like, smells it. And he was like, "Oh, my God, that's gross. What is that?" You know, and neither one of them recognize it. So whoever this, you know, masked vigilante lube man is, this is a new character to them. Pirate Jenny does ask, her line was, "He have any lettuce or watch batteries on him?" So they're, you know, wondering if perhaps he's related to the 7th Cavalry. There was nothing like that, you know, as part of that scene. Red Scare says, "Was he wearing a Rorschach and saying TikTok, TikTok?" So they're just trying to, you know, figure out who this person is. It's very, you know, even the police are unclear on this. Mm-hmm. Lori walks into Judd's office, Angela walks into Judd's office, and she sees Lori in there, and she's got her feet up on the desk, and she's just kind of relaxing. And she said that they got a lead on your car. You know, we dusted it for prints, and I got your prints and Cal's prints and the kids' prints. And then we found one other set of prints that we didn't know who it was. And she says, "You know, well, it could have been, you know, maybe one of your friends had ridden in the car," but her line is, "But you don't strike me as the kind of person who has friends." So Lori just, like, straight up, like, insults her, like, "You don't really strike me as the kind of person who would let somebody else ride in their car." So clearly these are Will's prints. Well, maybe not clearly. I mean, I guess they could be anybody's prints. But the implication here is that Will's prints have been found on the passenger side of the car, because that's where he was sitting when the car was taken away. And she's able to, you know, through her FBI connections, match these prints to someone on file. And she says that the prints match a cop in New York City, which is shocking to Angela, because Angela knows whose prints these are, but she didn't know he was a cop. I mean, she's just met this guy. He's told her, "Hey, I'm, you know, your grandfather. Oh, and by the way, I killed your chief of police." And now she finds out that he's a cop. So she's getting, like, these conflicting stories. Like, is he a good guy? Is he a bad guy? Is he telling me the truth? Is he not? Like, what? How much of this is fact and how much of it's fiction? So she's kind of blown away. And Lori actually mentions that, the file that these prints were from was you know, from a long time ago. So she says, by my math, he has to be over 100 years old by now. And do you know how 100-year-olds tend to get around, Angela? Wheelchairs. So she's not surprised that there are 100-year-old fingerprints in this car, which, I mean, I think it would be weird. You know, I mean, clearly Angela's like, you know, a family woman. It seems weird that she would be palling around with 100-year-olds, especially since she doesn't have family. But, you know, Lori's just more concerned about the fact that, hey, there was a really old person in your car at one point, and usually those kinds of people wear or get around in wheelchairs. So she's, you know, drawing some connections.
Because there's wheelchairs at the tracks, or wheelchair tracks at the scene of Judd's hanging.
She's letting Angela know, like, hey, you know, something hinky's going on here, and I'm watching you, right?
Yeah, I wasn't sure why she mentioned the wheelchair thing at first, but then I realized it's because she noticed the wheelchair tracks at the scene of Judd.
She's already skeptical of Angela's story, and now she's finding out that there was, you know, there were, you know, fingerprints in this car that Angela says she doesn't know about. Yeah, I think her skeptical meter has just gone up even more.
It doesn't strike me as that she is skeptical of her. It's more that she's, you know, she realizes her car got stolen. She thinks it's connected to Judd's murder. She knows that there was wheelchair marks there at the scene, and that the fact that it's an old person's print in the car connects those items. I don't necessarily get like a side eye from her to Angela, but maybe she's putting on an act. I don't know.
Okay.
She gets like a little message from her assistant Petey saying that she says there's another lead on the car thing. And so they get into a car and ride towards somewhere. We don't know yet, but they start talking about Angela wonders why the car is so important to Lori, and she explains that it went missing the night of his murder, and then it reappeared the night of the funeral. So she thinks it's connected, and that's why she's so concerned with it. And Angela kind of wants her to like lay off my car, dude. You know, and so that's what they talk. They talk about something else. Oh, Lori calls the car instance a thermodynamic miracle. She says it's a sciencey version of It's All Connected, Man. And her husband used to talk about it.
Not her husband, my ex.
Or her ex.
The full line is a thermodynamic miracle. It's the sciencey version of It's All Connected, Man. My ex used to talk about them when he wasn't distracted by fucking quarks. So what she's talking about Dr. Manhattan, right? She's saying that this is the sort of sciencey thing that Dr. Manhattan would maybe have said, or not maybe, did say. It's, you know, because Dr. Manhattan sees the universe differently, you know, everything is all connected, you know, in one way or another, the butterfly effect, that kind of thing. So.
Oh, wow. I didn't even know she was married to Dr. Manhattan. I thought she, like, maybe.
No, they weren't married. They were just dating, but yeah.
Okay, so she calls her ex-husband, though, right?
I know. I think she just says my ex. The quote that I have from the subtitles is just my ex, because they never got married. They end up breaking up because, you know, he can't be in a relationship.
Okay. Well, I wish there was more explanation. She just, like, says it's a thermodynamic miracle, and then, you know, kind of blows it off. Like, I would have appreciated more explanation of what that is other than a fancy term.
I think what she's saying here is she says, you know, that it's connected, that these things are connected. This murder and your car are connected. And she uses that fancy term, a thermodynamic miracle, as a way of saying that things are connected without implying that she's looking at or investigating Angela. I think she's just kind of letting her know This is just a really weird coincidence. Like you said, maybe she's investigating Angela. Maybe she's looking at the 7th Cavalry or picking on Angela. She doesn't know, but she's just saying that, you know what? It's just too weird that your car gets stolen and returned, you know, on these specific dates.
Yeah, and that's all you need. You don't need this term thermodynamic miracle thrown in there. Other than for maybe people like you who have heard that referenced other places and understand more context around that term, but I don't.
I don't remember thermodynamic miracle from the comic. I only remember Laurie saying it, and it comes up later in the episode. I think this is like the Chekhov's gun of the thermodynamic miracle. I think they drop that here and just so they can mention it again later.
Okay. So they also talk about her husband Cal. So Lori reveals that she talked with Cal and that they met in Vietnam. And they also talk about Angela's costume for a bit, like, you know, and that, Lori used to be a costume person. And then they get into the subject of trauma. I think because Lori thinks that most costumed people have some sort of trauma. So Lori tells Petey to tell Angela about her trauma. She's like, go ahead, tell him about my history.
Well, Angela doesn't believe her, right? She says, yeah, people that wear masks, you know, they're, you know, hiding some sort of trauma. And Angela says, I wear the mask to protect myself. And Lori, like, without missing a beat, says, right, from the pain. Because she's like, everyone that does this, like, she's like, you're in denial. Everybody's got trauma, and we find out about Angela's trauma a little bit in the future. But what she's saying is, it's not normal to put on a mask and go out and fight crime. I mean, that's sort of the crux of the whole Batman scenario from the get-go. Is you gotta be a little bit screwed up in the head to want to go out and punch bad guys and put your life on the line for nothing. You're not getting paid. You're not even famous. Not really. It's because nobody knows who you are. So like, why are you doing this? Like the whole concept. And Lori's just saying, look, lady, you got to own it. I've been there. I used to be a masked hero and I was messed up in the head. And she's like, I don't know. You don't know what trauma is. And then she was like, well, Petey, go ahead and explain.
Yeah, but Angela is getting paid. She works for the police.
True.
She's not seeking fame. It seems to be the law of the land. Like, there's a very good reason why police officers wear masks in this setup. So, I guess I just don't really agree with... I agree with your... Definitely your take on her point of view. I don't agree that that's the thesis of the show so far, that it's crazy to wear a mask, I guess. I could be wrong. I mean, that definitely could be flipped on its head. But so far, I think that's given at least Angela and like the police force here a very good reason for, number one, it's the law. And then number two, you know, it's actually protecting them, their identities because of the White Knight and all of that. So I do want to say I really do want to understand the thesis of this show. I've said it before. I really want to understand like what the show is trying to say, and that would be a really interesting one. And it had not occurred to me until you just said that's the whole situation. So
I wouldn't say that's the entire thesis of the show. I think we sort of get back to the, and I'm not going to butcher the Latin, whatever it is, the quistos custodis, whatever. I mean, the fundamental theme of the Watchmen is who watches the Watchmen, who keeps an eye on the people that are in power. There are a lot of really powerful people out there. You got people like Lady True or Elon Musk or whoever, and they're rich and powerful and they can get away with anything. Somebody needs to be keeping an eye on them. That's clearly what, you know, Angela is doing. That's what Lori is doing. They're detectives and they're holding everybody accountable regardless of who or what they are. But but Lori's point is to do that job, to want to get up in the middle of the night and go out and do those things. Maybe there's something a little bit off about you, and that's not bad, but you got to own it. Don't pretend that you're a happy family man or a happy, you know, that everything is all sunshine and rainbows in your life, because it's not. Because she survived the White Knight. She's got major trauma. We'll get into it in the future. I mean, her parents are murdered in front of her. It's, yeah. So I think what she's just saying is, like, you need to be honest with yourself about why you do that, about why you get up, why you put on a suit, because, you know, you could go get a job at a bank, or you could go, you know, whatever. There's a lot of things you could do.
Yeah, and it is true that she's one of the few officers that didn't resign when that White Knight happened. So there is something different about her, for sure, that's motivating her. So, yeah, that's true.
Ultimately, Petey does explain, because remember, Petey is a true historian. He basically explains Laurie's trauma. And I think I've mentioned it in the past that Laurie's father is the comedian and Laurie's mom was the original Silk Spectre. There was some sexual assault there. There was some rape there, which is where Laurie comes from. So when she comes to term, Laurie is, I don't even know, 16, 17, 18, when she finds out about her dad being the comedian. And so it was very traumatic on her finding out that her dad was essentially an a-hole and that, you know, he was not nice to her mom. And, you know, when you're in your formative years and you haven't really known your dad because they were not together. I mean, I guess she knew him, but, like, you know, it wasn't like they grew up and, you know, sitting around family dinner. The point was, is that, you know, she had some trauma dealing with her parents and their shitty relationship. And, you know, it trickled over onto her. So it's just interesting that Laurie, you know, rather than telling the story herself, she gives Petey a moment to shine. She was like, look, you probably know more about me than I do. You tell the story. and I think, yeah, because Petey mentions the comedian and Silk Spectre, and Angela says, oh, you mean the people from that Minutemen show? And Petey just goes, ugh. That he just does not like that show because of its historical inaccuracies, right? He's a hardcore history nerd, and that's essentially the sensationalized TV version of what really happened.
Mm-hmm.
The next thing we see, the car arrives. They arrive at True headquarters, and they kind of see, you get a long pan up shot of the Millennium Clock, and they kind of, you know, look at it and they kind of marvel at it, because it's, you know, it's a cool looking building. You know, I want to say it defies physics. Like, there's some moving parts and there's some floating parts. It's very science fiction-y looking. They walk inside the, I guess, warehouse portion of this, and there's a drone. It looks like, you know, a drone you would see now, somebody flying on their cell phone, but this was before those were a thing, really, I think. And I mean, it's huge. I don't know. It's probably 15 feet by 15 feet. It's like what are those things they drive around and wear? A forklift. It's like a forklift, but a hovercraft, you know, and it moves things around. And Laurie wants to know, you know, hey, oh, that thing's interesting. It's big. And, you know, I wonder if you could have maybe used that to move a car. And Laurie says, hey, I need a list of anybody who could fly these drones. And he says, oh, well, there's a very small list of people who could do it, you know, and all the people that can fly one of these, you know, they work here and they were all accounted for last night. And, you know, it'd be really weird that somebody would have used this, you know, and we wouldn't have known about it. So they ask, you know, for an official list. Can we get a list of all the people who can fly these? And Bien takes over, the Lady True's daughter takes over and says, oh, mother would like to invite you to have tea in her vivarium. And, you know, I'll be happy to get you that list of who, you know, could pilot these things. And they all, like, okay, well, let's go have some tea. And so they start walking, and Bien walks over to Petey, and she says, oh, so sorry, ladies only. And Petey's, like, dejected. He was like, oh, well, I'll just wait in the car then. Like, poor Petey never gets any respect. And as they're walking towards the vivarium, we see that, you know, they have, the characters have a little minute to talk. And, you know, they're looking at the windows, these glass windows, at this Millennium Clock. And she says, you know, what are you building? And Bien makes mention of the Library of Alexandria and the pyramids. I can't remember. And, you know, talking about the seven wonders of the world. And BN says, no, 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 we're not working on the eighth wonder of the world. We're working on the first wonder of the new world, because the Library of Alexandria burned down. You know, none of the seven wonders of the world are still around, I think, except the pyramids and the Great Wall of China. The rest of them are all gone. So the point is that, you know, that's Lady True has aspirations to, you know, put her mark on the world, right? I think we talked about it a little bit earlier when she was negotiating with the Clarks, you know, like you need to have a legacy. Your legacy is going to be your children here. So I think that's what Lady True is trying to do here, is cement her legacy in the world. And as they're walking, Sister Knight says, well, what does it do? And Bien, without missing a beat, says, it tells time. And that's it.
Hmm. Mm-hmm. In the Vivarium, they start talking to Lady True, and they question her about the stolen car. They also mention Vietnam. They were both, I guess they were talking about how she came from Vietnam, and then Lori mentions that, well, Angela or Sister Knight is from Vietnam as well. And so they give each other like a little eye contact, I guess, about that. And then they ask for the list of everyone who knows how to fly one of the ships. Lady True gives condolences about Judd, about the death. She says she's never met him, but she heard he was a very great person. Lady True then says she knows an old Vietnamese proverb or saying. But then says something in Vietnamese. She says, your grandfather wants to know if you got the pills. Basically hiding her communication to Angela from Lori, the FBI agent. And then Angela responds in Vietnam.
In Vietnamese.
Or Vietnamese, sorry. Tell that old fucker he can ask me himself. and then Lori points to a statue of Adrian Veidt. It's like a big golden statue. But she notes that it's like he looks old in the statue.
Well, so Lady True and Angela are talking in Vietnamese, so Lori doesn't know what they're saying. And, you know, they're sort of like insulting each other just a little bit. And then in the middle of it, Lori goes, holy shit, is that Adrian Veidt? Like, she's excited to see this statue, right?
Hmm.
And, yeah, she says, why did you make him so old? And you have to remember that, so Lori was in the Minutemen when Veidt was in the Minutemen. She was really young. But so she knew, you know, Veidt when he, just prior to him doing his dropping squids on New York thing. So this is 30 years ago. So she knew him when he was in his prime. He was a young, good-looking guy. And she's confused, you know, because it's a statue of a guy wearing a Veidt suit. So it's very clearly an homage to Veidt, but it's old Veidt. It's the Veidt that we see from, you know, the castle subplot. And she's confused. Well, why did you make him old? Why would you build a statue of someone and not have them at their prime? It'd be like, you know, you built a statue, you know, to commemorate Arnold Schwarzenegger. You're not going to do it when he's 75. You're going to do it when he's 30, when he's in his prime, right? And then she says, Lady True agrees. Yes, that is Adrian Veidt. And she says, so much of my success grew from the seed of his inspiration. And Lori says, oh, and you bought his company right after he disappeared. And Lady True responds, that too. So clearly, a lot of Lady True's success has come from, you know, picking up what was left of Veidt's empire after he disappeared after the squid thing. So again, I mean, he's been gone from this universe for 30 years. I don't want to go into too much more in this scene, because all of this comes back and it's very important.
It seems weird. Like, there's something weird going on here.
For sure.
We know Adrian Veidt is trapped in some, you know, upside down or whatever. And they have this statue of him in, like, gold, which doesn't really look like a statue you would want to have in your apartment. And it's just a weird thing. So you wonder what's going on. I do definitely wonder what's going on. I have no idea, but.
Yeah, we'll talk about it at the end. I'm hoping that's one of your questions, because I'm curious your take on it. So.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I don't know. The next scene is Adrian Veidt is in a boat. Well, okay. I was talking about like how the cut zooms into the gold dude's face. So I guess I'll read it.
Does it? I missed that. So it zooms in on like the statue's face.
Yes. The end of this conversational scene between Lady True, Angela, and Laura, it's zooming in to the statue's face, and then we cut to like a night scene on a boat. And we see that Adrian Veidt is like pulling a cage out of the water with what looks like fetuses. He throws a couple away. He like inspects one and it's not good enough, so he throws it away. And then we see him carrying a bag into like a basement lab location. It looks similar to another scene with him and the clones. I can't remember exactly what scene that was. It's not the play, but it seems like the same area. But he puts these, there's two of them, he puts them into this like big cylindrical machine.
Like a pressure chamber or something.
Yeah, and he like seals it shut. He turns it on and it starts spinning around. It cuts away, but we hear like squishes and babies crying and like kind of gross sound.
I would say, I mean, the babies were like screaming, right? I mean, they were not, it wasn't just like crying because they're hungry or they were uncomfortable, right?
Yeah, no, it was.
Right.
Yeah, it was. It wasn't like screaming, like really piercing, but it was definitely not happy noise.
Right. Yeah.
So it cuts away while we're hearing this. We don't see what's going on with this machine. And he turns on some music, starts eating some of the cake we've seen before that is made. You know, my comment here is, what the fuck?
Indeed.
It cuts back to this contraption. We see two naked adults spinning around. It's slowing down.
It's like real time, right? That was the impression I got from that. I mean, it was 5-10 minutes tops. It wasn't like, you know, they were in there for a day and a half.
Yeah, I wasn't sure about that, how long it was taking. Yeah. But yeah, it could be just, yeah, real time.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe 30 seconds, maybe.
Yeah, sure.
If it was real time. So we see that it is another clone of Crookshanks and Mr. Phillips,
mm-hmm.
those same looking people. And then he's talking to them. It shows them traveling in a carriage of some sort, and he's talking to them, saying that they'll be able to talk in an hour or so. He says, while I am your master, I am most definitely not your maker. I would never have burdened such a pathetic creatures with the gift of life. But to be alive, you have to have purpose, and you have to, and you have none except to serve. He takes them into the castle, and we see a bunch of dead bodies of the same previous clone bodies, the same looking dudes, you know, everywhere. Bloody, it looks like a really big massacre happened.
And Veidt says, I have, like, it's no big deal. He's like, oh, I apologize for the mess. And there's just, what? I mean, I don't know, like 50 corpses in that room, and they're stabbed. And I mean, they're just all kind. It was clearly just a massacre. And he's just like, oh, I apologize for the mess. I had a rough night is what he says.
Yeah. Yeah. So weirdness, more weirdness. He like grabs a horseshoe really quickly and says, I don't need it yet, which is weird.
He grabs it out of the hand of a corpse of a Mr. Phillips and says, I don't need it yet.
Yeah. So then we go to a catapult, and they're loading bodies into a catapult.
Real quick before you go too much farther, mm-hmm. right after he grabs that horseshoe from Phillips's corpse, there is a shot of the yellow and purple cake, and it has four candles on it. So this is, you know, just in line with what we've seen before. The first episode had a cake with one candle. The second one had two candles. We're up to four candles now. So we're celebrating four some things.
Oh, yeah. He mentions later that...
He mentions later that, yeah, it's been 4 years, yes.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's a good eye. So, yeah, they're at this catapult. I mean, I'll just say it right here. He should be using a trebuchet. It's clearly superior to a catapult.
Right.
And that's the most I'll say about that issue. Okay.
That's your problem with this show? That
that's where I dropped off. Yeah.
The show was great until the catapult.
It's literally unwatchable. Okay.
Okay.
So yeah, they seem to be loading the bodies onto this catapult and launching them into the clouds. They seem to just disappear into the sky. He seems to be like taking notes and sort of repeating the process, like, I don't know, utilizing different settings on this catapult, maybe.
So what we see here is this is why he's been saving all of the corpses. Remember when he saved that corpse from the plague and he says, oh, we'll have a use for him soon. His plan was apparently to catapult a bunch of corpses into space.
Yeah, which explains so much.
It's a normal thing to do.
Oh, yeah. Now I understand everything.
It all clicks, right?
It all makes sense. So he goes into like a bit of a monologue about he's been here for 4 years. It's been 4 years since he was sent here. He thought it was paradise at first, but then he realized it was a prison. And he says he'll use these clones to escape this place. So we know he's trapped there. He's trying to escape. It doesn't really ground any of this information, though. Like, this is my note. It just, we just learn more weird stuff. It doesn't, mm-hmm. it doesn't really tell us anything, I think. But we do learn more weird stuff. So that's cool.
We do possibly learn why he was having Mr. Phillips wear that metal, you know, space suit with the oxygen. And remember, we see him, I guess maybe it's implied, but that's what he was doing, was putting Mr. Phillips in that spacesuit and launching him and essentially bringing him back. If I remember right, it's really, it doesn't show it, but I think he was tying a rope around him and then pulling him back basically to see if he could survive in space or if he would run out of oxygen.
Oh, I did not catch that.
That may come up in the future, but that's what he was doing with. He was trying to see if he could catapult a person off of wherever he is.
So then why is he just launching bodies, like, without any suits?
You'll see. It's coming up.
Okay. All right.
Because they're dead, so he's got nothing left to lose.
Okay. Okay, sure. Okay.
All right, so the next scene is the interior of the Abar household at night. Angela walks in. And Cal is sitting on the couch, and he is up reading. He's reading a book called Things Fall Apart. And Angela's a little frustrated with him, and she spoils the ending of his book. I forget what the character's name is. She basically says, oh, you know, whatever, John dies at the end. And he was like, you know, okay, whatever. And so she's frustrated that Cal had talked to Lori and didn't mention anything about it, because clearly Lori's investigating them, and so Angela's, you know, a little, you know, alarmed about that, and she wants to know what Cal told her. And so, you know, he says Lori came by earlier, she asked me who called during the white night. He tells her this whole story about, you know, oh, I told her that, you know, on the night of the white night that you disappeared. And then you told me that your grandfather killed Judd, and I was confused because I didn't even know she had a grandfather. Like, he just lays it all out, and Angela's, you know, I think for 1 second she's like panicking, like, holy shit, did he just, you know, give away all of my secrets? And then he goes, you know, she says, "You didn't tell her anything." And he says, "No, I didn't tell her anything." But like he's clearly like winding her up a little bit. He was like, "Look, she came out and we talked. I didn't tell her anything. I'm on Team Angela. I'm not on Team Lori. I'm not going to sell you out." But he's, you know, I think he's kind of implying like, you got to keep me in the loop here. You know, you keep just going off and doing your own thing. Now you've got a grandpa. Judd's been killed. Our kids are kind of scarred by this murder at this cemetery. Like, what's going on? Like, I want to be on your side, but you're not giving me enough to go on. You know, he's letting her know that I'm still on your side, but please keep me in the loop because I don't know how much longer I can, you know, keep making stuff up. Cal is kind of convinced that, you know, he says Lori wants to help, you know, maybe he can help you find that old man, you know, and Lori, yeah. Or and Angela says, "Well, I don't need help finding him, you know, I mean, because she already knows where he is." And, you know, so she kind of goes back and forth. I mean, she was just trying to pick a fight with Cal to, you know, get a rise out of him so that, you know, she could let him know that she was a little upset. And he came back at her and said, you know, "Hey, essentially, yeah, I'm a little ticked at you too, because you're doing a lot of sketchy shit and you're not letting me know." So the scene ends, you know, they make up, they've both.
I want to say something about this.
Sure.
Sorry. I think it's really interesting, this husband character, Cal. He kind of represents like the 2D wife character that's like kind of unrelentingly supportive and like kind of perfect and kind of sure. always supportive. It almost is a very progressive thing to have the man sort of like not take the bait on the argument, sort of support her, you know, be and sort of just be there. As someone who supports the character in the story, not, you know, he's not really anything more than someone that he doesn't really have his own character yet. They talk about him having an accident, so maybe that comes up later, but he really doesn't have any character unto himself. He's really more of just a character to represent and be bounce off Angela. So I find that progressive and pretty interesting. And yeah, you're right. He doesn't take, he sort of like just kind of represents the perfect husband at this point. Yeah.
He's the foil to Angela's character, right? She's hot and, you know, impulsive and, you know, has gone off the rails a couple times. And I think his job, both as her husband and as a character, I think is kind of to rein her in, you know, to be her, I want to say to be her conscience or to be her, you know, to be the good angel that sits on her shoulder and is like, you know, "Hey, are you, yeah. you really, is this what you want to do? Like, is this, you know, you're a cop, like you have resources, you can do this the right way. Like you don't have to," I mean, he doesn't know that she has in essence kidnapped Will or she's breaking into the cultural center, that kind of thing. Like, so yeah. I think he just serves as a foil to her hotheadedness.
Yeah, yes, I right. could just totally see the roles reversed.
Yeah,
in a different situation.
What do you think about Cal as a character? I mean, he hasn't had a whole lot to do. I mean, he's kind of vanilla, right? He's kind of boring.
Well, that's what I was just saying. He's very 2D, perfect husband.
Yeah. Okay.
You know, like, yeah, isn't really a character. He's really just someone that represents the main character Angela in a way that's very familiar if you're looking at, you know, rough and tumble detectives, like, you know, that have wives that try to rein them in, and, you know, it's a very trope type of situation with usually a man who's
sure,
you know, not being truthful to their to his family, kind of going off the rails. You know, you empathize with them because you're following them through this whole story, and the wife character is reasonably, you know, curious and upset, but ultimately doesn't really provide any major conflict with it. They are supportive. Yeah. I found it interesting, and Cal does seem like a very 2D character at this point, but I think it's
that's a good description. Yeah, 2D. He's very textbook, yeah. Right? Ultimately, we got to wrap things up. So ultimately, the scene ends. They've, you know, both kind of said their piece. You know, they were frustrated with each other. They've said their piece. They're happy now. The scene ends with Angela saying, I'll meet you in the closet, clearly a reference to when they were having sex in the closet. Apparently, that's a thing they do a lot. And then the scene ends. And then the last scene, I want you to walk us through this last scene because I'm curious what you take away from this. So do you want to talk about the last scene?
Well, I guess I can try. Yeah, because it doesn't really make a lot of sense to me. But we cut to Bien waking up from like a bad dream. She's like panting, breathing heavily. It seems like we have an IV of some sort. Putting liquid into her arm. She puts on her glasses. She walks out of her room and she tells her mom, Lady True, she had a nightmare. She, I guess Lady True is very interested in this nightmare and she describes it. She says, I was in a village. Men came and burned it. And then they made us walk and I was walking for so long. And then she says, Mom, my feet still hurt. Lady True says, good, which is weird. Bien asks if she will walk her back to bed, and she says, no. So Bien is walking away, and she says goodnight to Mr. Reeves. Goodnight, Mr. Reeves. So we learn that he's just kind of sitting there.
There's a slope. Yeah, she says, goodnight, Mr. Reeves. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so he's hearing all of this. And there's a very slow pan to the left, and you see Will sitting in his wheelchair just kind of like watching.
Yeah, which is odd. Mm-hmm. It seemed like a very personal moment for mm-hmm. them. And then like, oh, yeah, there's an old dude there. and then the Will and Lady True appears to resume their conversation. He says, you're worried. And she says she's concerned about the pills, saying something about it being too cute. And she's, Will says, well, aren't you doing the same thing with your daughter? And then she says, that's different. No. And then she says something along the lines of, well, when family gets involved, feet get cold, people do irrational things, so on and so forth. And he says, no, my feet are just fine. And then he asks how much longer. True says 3 days, and then Will says she'll know what I have done. She'll hate me for it. And then he says I'm in all the way, and then he starts saying tick tock, tick tock. And I think that's it.
The big reveal in this scene is that Will stands up and walks away at the end of the scene. So,
oh, I mean, I didn't really notice that.
Yeah. So what he said, yeah, like you said, because he says my feet work just fine. I'm in all the way. You know, Lady True is worried that maybe he's going to back out. You know, if things get too heated with his daughter, he says, no, I'm in all the way. And he stands up from his wheelchair and you see him kind of walk away. And they both kind of look up, you know, it's night and they're looking out the, you know, greenhouse or whatever. And they look up at the millennium clock spinning. So.
Yeah, I mean, this scene literally meant nothing to me. I have no idea what any of this means. It's kind of frustrating because it's just more weird additions to the story without grounding anything or anything actually explaining what is going on. So it's just.
Sure.
Again, it's just like building on more weird.
It's you things. Know, it's ending on a cliffhanger. So I think the takeaway from the scene, and this is what I'm curious. I mean, I don't expect you to pick up on this because it's very obscure. But yeah, what Lady True says that she thinks Will is being cute with the pills instead of just telling Angela his story, and Will responds, "Well, isn't that exactly the same thing you're doing with your daughter?" So whatever's going on, so there's a Will-Angela relationship, and there's a True Bien relationship, and they're both weird, right? Something's going on there. Do we, and I was going to look it up, I forgot. Do we know the pills that Will is taking? Do they ever cut to what those pills are? Or is that explained later? Am I not remembering?
No, I don't think there's any idea what those pills are, no.
Okay, all right. Then I won't give it away. But the pills are clearly very important. I mean, even Angela realizes that because she's having Wade's ex-girlfriend, you know, analyze them. And Lady True is whatever, doing something similar with her daughter. There's weird familial relationships just all abound, all around in this episode. So the episode ends. The closing song is Time Is On My Side. So clearly there is a theme of time and clocks. And again, Lady True said, you know, whatever is going on is going to be revealed within 3 days. So yeah, that's kind of the episode. A lot of eggs and, you know, a lot more mysteries. What do you have on your list of unanswered questions? Has anything been answered, or are you just even more confused now than ever?
No, I have quite a few answered stuff here. So Lori Blake, we know her dad and mom were Silk Spectre and the comedian. We know she dated Dr. Manhattan. So we know more about her from this. The flying spaceships being a thing is answered. We know it's like Lady True's things. Or at least we know it's probably from that. The old man, so we've learned some more things. There's obviously still a lot of questions, but we know the spaceship magnet thing saves him. It was probably Lady True or someone in that organization that, you know, rescued him. The car falling from the sky makes more sense. Angela's relationship to him, this is answered, you know, pretty clearly. We learned he's working with Lady True. That's important.
He did say, remember, you know, I have friends in high places.
Yeah.
And so he sort of knew that, you know, that car was going to get picked up. Remember when when Angela was loading him into the car from the wheelchair, like he's looking up at the sky, like he was expecting to get bailed out by Lady True.
Yeah. And we know something's going on with the millennial clock, and that will make Angela mad. That specifically is interesting to me. He, you know, it's something that seems to be very against Angela, or whatever it is. It's Angela is not going to like it, but yet he's trying to reach out to her and like teach her things and try to get her to understand things. But like what he's doing is going to make her mad. So that doesn't make sense to me, but okay. I'm in the answered question section. Adrian Veidt, the clones. So as they dispose of the bride clone body, he says we'll use them for before long. So we learn they're launching the bodies into the sky.
And totally normal thing to do.
Yeah, we learn he's trapped there and he's trying to escape. That's about it. I mean, that's all we learn. So these are questions that I kind of gave up on and I'm probably not going to get answered, but who knows? We'll see.
Okay.
The chrome head guy, we still don't know why it's a mirror. New, he has an underground lab studying the squid rain, which is interesting, I guess. I get that it's maybe just more texture to the show, but in service of what? I'd like to get more information about his character to understand what it means for him. Like, does everything have to be a mystery? Like this, like specifically this character, Wade. Does he need to be a mystery box too? I get that there's a lot of mystery boxes, but like he seems to be close to Angela. He seems to be someone that doesn't seem super connected to things, you know. I mean, he's an important character in the show, and he's close. He was close to Judd and everyone. I would rather know more information about him up front to have more grounding with, especially with that scene where she's confronting him with the KKK outfit. Like that felt empty to me because we don't know enough about Wade to know what's going on, you know, with him. So
we definitely get more Wade. So, I mean, he definitely comes back in the future. I think okay. What you really need to know about Wade is I would say that Wade Looking Glass is kind of Angela's best friend. Like, that's her work best friend. It's the one person that she really trusts above and beyond everyone else. I mean, she gives him those pills and says, hey, you know, I need you to do me a favor on the down low and look into this kind of thing. So we definitely get a little bit more of his backstory. But I think, you know, as you're explaining some of this, Wade is a weird character. He's very much, you know, an analog to Rorschach, who was very much an anti-hero. He was just kind of this weird character who fought the good fight for the wrong reasons. So what what I'm taking away, especially after rewatching it and talking about this today, is how broken you have to be, or I guess in Wade's case, to do what he does, to get up and, you know, put your life on the line and do these investigations. And he doesn't have a family to fall back on like Angela. So, like, he doesn't have anyone to keep him grounded, to keep him, you know, on the straight and narrow path. Like, he's this kind of creepy, weird dude who lives in this house by himself, and he, you know, eats beans right out of the can, and for fun he goes out and photographs squids, and then, you know, develops the pictures in his basement. You know,
would you say he's an empathetic character so far, though?
No.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, you know, I guess he's empathetic, you know, when he's in the pod and he's trying to break that 7th Cavalry member, and he's asking, you know, what does he say? Are you now, or have you ever been associated with the 7th Cavalry? You know, he's a good guy. I mean, that's the whole point of his character, is that he's, you know, trying to get to the bottom of this mystery. But as a character, as a person, I don't think, you know, he's not particularly empathetic, and I don't think he's supposed to be. I think he's supposed to be that weirdo outsider character, you know, no. who's.
Yeah, but I think he can be a weird outsider character and be empathetic.
Sure.
I just don't think that they're building him up as an empathetic best friend character in the show. At least for me, I guess he comes off as like there's more to the story. There's maybe he's a double agent, or maybe he's working with the 7th Cavalry, or, you know, because obviously he's a parallel to Rorschach, who was a white supremacist, who inspired the 7th Cavalry, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, that obviously heavily implies he's maybe a bad guy. So that's just... there's just too much going on with that character for me to think that any of it's going to be resolved, but we'll see. Okay.
The only other question I have for you is, what do you think, or what did you take away from the very first scene about the Clarks and the baby and Lady True wanting to buy that farm? Do you have any, you know, guesses about what's going on there?
Guesses?
Yeah, why is Lady True want that farm so bad? Why? Well, yeah, let's just go with that.
Build her millennial clock thing, right? She just wanted to, like, it was maybe one area that you know, she was having trouble obtaining for her, you know, seventh wonder / new wonder of the new world after some sort of Armageddon takes place, right? I don't know.
Okay, interesting. Why? I mean, if that's the case, well, I mean, I don't want to give too much away. If that's the case, if she's just trying to acquire land to, you know, expand the Millennium Clock, why does she have to go? Why does she have to do it and not an army of lawyers? Why does she have to go at 10 o'clock at night and only give them 3 minutes to make a decision?
That's a good question. It didn't make any sense to me why she needed to do that personally, other than to say maybe they've been holdouts and maybe she really needed to make an impression. And she obviously did with, like, the, like, here's a fucking baby.
Clearly, she wanted, like, that land.
Yeah, she really wanted badly. It. I get that she really wanted it. I don't know what more to it there is. I mean, they built up that couple as being incredibly desperate for a baby, and they were incredibly fast to accept the offer. I don't know. Okay, I'm intrigued that you even asked that question, because it seemed like such an obvious on-the-nose.
No. Thing. You need to write that down on your list, sir.
Well, it is in my list of questions, like, what's the deal with the family and Lady True wanting their land? The 3-minute timer specifically made me weird out a little bit. Like, why does there need to be this weird constraint of a 3-minute timer, hourglass? That is the one thing that made me think.
How does that scene end? Do you remember?
Well, she signed the paper, and that, you know, that was it, right?
No. She got him to sign, and then...
Yeah.
And then they went out on the porch.
Oh, there was a thing that fell down, yeah.
Oh. Okay.
So that was timed with the timer that she had going?
Oh, not necessarily. I mean, yeah, maybe. Yeah. I don't want to give too much away, but I mean, that was there's a reason that she wants. I don't want to spoon feed it to you, but her wanting that farm has nothing to do with the Millennium Clock.
Okay. All right. Well, that's cool.
What do you think? Okay, this is, we're going to talk all night here. What do you think of Lady True as a character? Do you like her? You hate her? She's, what do you think?
Well, you mentioned, like, she's so powerful. I don't think they've really shown how, like, powerful or influential she has been in the show. Like, this is the first we've seen of her.
Mm-hmm.
She has to show up personally at this house and, like, present this baby to this couple that seems to be a very desperate move to get this land. She doesn't have any influence in law enforcement, it doesn't seem like, or in politics that I have noticed there's no connection with her into the greater institutions of power. So I'm very unconvinced of her power, I guess I would say.
Okay. I mean, she's a self-proclaimed trillionaire. So she is.
Yeah, but that, what does that mean?
She's got influence. How about that?
Yeah, but she says she does. That's not a demonstration of anything.
She's got enough power that she can build a Millennium Clock. She's got enough, you know,
yeah,
technological people know who she is because she's got that fleet of Dr. Manhattan phone booths, right? You know, so yeah. she's.
Oh, is that hers? Those phone booths? I didn't.
Yeah, so I don't know. It was probably before you knew who she was, but if in the last episode when she gets into the phone booth, here I'm looking at my notes. When Lori picks up the phone, it says that it's connecting to a true satellite orbital array connected to the Mars antenna. So, yes, those phone booths are all, a part of Lady True's, you know, I don't know what the word is, empire.
Oh, okay. I didn't know that. Yeah, and people talk about her like she's well-known.
Mm-hmm.
So there's that. But, yeah, I guess I would have appreciated more of like a more powerful demonstration of her power. But
you get a lot more Lady True, so you just you wait.
Okay. I mean, that makes sense. She seems like she does seem like a pivotal person in the conflict, but I do think she's important to what's going on. I just didn't get as much of like a power level from her.
You don't get a lot in this episode. I don't expect you to. That I'm not trying to bait you. Like, oh, you missed all this. It's just more of a, what do you think of this character? I love the way she walks into that farm and she was like, okay, you got to give me this house. And they're like, no. And she was like, no, you don't understand. I've already made you a bait. Like, she just throws her weight around. She takes shit from no one.
So if it's so time sensitive, but yet she's had a lot of time to make a baby. Why couldn't she have been in talks with these people for months ahead of time? Like, this, obviously this baby has been made and that takes months, maybe, right?
We'll talk. That's a good point. And I honestly don't remember how that piece ends up, but we'll talk about that. It most certainly comes back why Lady True is so adamant about getting this farm. And I think she even says she says, you're the most important people on the planet for the next 3 minutes. So it's a big deal. All right.
Yeah.
I think we've covered everything I can think of. We could beat this, dead horse forever. So, all right. We'll be back, for the next episode. Any closing thoughts? Or are we good? We talked for a long time.
No, I just still have a long list of questions, but that's the way it goes.
All right. Bye-bye.